Welcome to a very special Reason podcast. This is the pre-finale edition of our Game of Thrones podcasting. I am Catherine Mengu Ward, and I am here with my colleagues Peter Suderman and Robbie Suave. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
We have lots to say about Game of Thrones. Before we begin, spoilers, spoilers, all the spoilers. This podcast is full of spoilers. You have no one to blame but yourself if you continue into the spoilers.
Possibly even spoilers for things that aren't Game of Thrones.
Yeah, spoilers for everything. Just say it right there.
Yeah, don't listen. Turn this off.
Okay. So we are recording before the final episode because this is a crucial moment, a pivotal moment in the show. A lot has happened since our last podcast, which was right before the season began. First of all, let's start with Robbie. You were right about everything.
Thank you.
What specifically were you right about?
It's very gratifying. Long have I predicted that Daenerys would take this turn, mostly because I just don't like Daenerys very much. And I have so radicalized this office against her that I think we're all occasionally surprised when we go out into the real world and find out that actually she's like the most popular character on the show and people like her. You know, she's a rampaging neoconservative. She believes in nation building, regime change. And I was delighted to see her take this turn finally, although I have some questions about the execution.
She's a rampaging neoconservative who is nevertheless really, really liked by the left. Right.
Like, for instance, the Elizabeth Warren, right. The world needs fewer Cersei Lannisters and more Daenerys Stormborns piece in New York Magazine, which I think we can all agree is just, it just tastes so delicious.
King's Landing burns
now,
Elizabeth Warren hardest
to see
hit.
That piece. Yes, absolutely. I've been interested in the feminist backlash to the, what we would say is the reveal of Dany's evil, but which some people would say is the sudden and unexpected and non-telegraphed plot twist of Dany's evil. I'd be like, right after that episode on Twitter, I saw a lot of women being like, God damn it, Game of Thrones, how dare you promise me a strong woman leader and then make her suddenly be all bitches be crazy. This seems nuts to me since there's currently a woman on the throne. There is still a good chance a woman will be on the throne in the form of Sansa. Why did the feminists love Dany so much?
I do think the show opened itself up to that criticism because the showrunners have suggested that it was like she was snapping or going crazy in the way Targaryens are known for, when really it was much more complicated than that. It's, you know, we've seen her, we described it as like a going mad or losing her grip or something, but it's really been more of a realizing that she has to rule through force and through fear and not through love, realizing that these people will not accept her as their legitimate monarch unless she makes like a show of overwhelming force. I mean, that's the realization she's kind of come to.
It wasn't. I would actually dispute that at least a little bit or question it. When the turn she makes... Well, it's obviously been quite set up. The way that it actually happens seems like she just snapped. It doesn't seem like she suddenly came to a realization. She did come to there was a decision process that led to her burning much of King's Landing early in the episode. But the moment at which she snaps, at which she says, no, I'm going to take this much further than I need to, much further than I had at least sort of tentatively agreed to. You know, she'd at least suggested that she would stop when the bells rang, because that indicated surrender. And instead, the bells ring and she's just like, nope, I'm taking the whole city down. And we don't really see the process there. It just sort of, she gets a crazy look in her eyes and that's it. And it really seems to me to suggest that there is a kind of a Targaryen madness that overtakes her, probably in response to the sequence of things that have happened, not just kind of randomly, and it has always been something that has always been part of her personality, right? I mean, and this is something an argument you've made.
But we also do have the scene, I guess, But we have her by the fire saying, they love you, Jon Snow. There are leaders and rulers that they have loved, the people of Westeros, and I am not one of them, and I have only fear. Like, we do have her explicitly saying that before making that decision.
I mean, in the backstory here, the long ago backstory, right, when Robert Baratheon conquers King's Landing, overthrows the Targaryens, it is the Lannisters which is the army that attacks King's Landing, the Mad King still on the throne, and sacks the city. It rapes, pillages, and so on. The Mad King, in response, says, you know, okay, I've lost, I'm going to burn the city down, and gives orders to light caches of wildfire to destroy the city, and then Jaime kills him to stop that from happening. But so there was her father obviously wanted to burn the city for no gain, although he felt he had nothing to lose because he was going to die anyway. But the Lannisters attacked, you know, they attacked the city. They did what Dany just did, but she had dragons to like really fully destroy it.
It's the firebombing of Dresden versus Hiroshima.
Yeah.
Just the weaponry that's different.
Yeah, but I totally agree that they didn't. I mean, I have a lot of criticism on the execution of all of this. It was very rushed, and so they did make it look like it was a snap crazy thing, when if they had handled it differently, there was a much more, no, she's doing this because this is what you have to do to rule. And not that that's praiseworthy or an endorsement of, I mean, John would rule differently. That's one of the reasons we're being, yet he would inspire loyalty and so on and so forth. But Danny's path to the throne is a path of fire and blood.
I think it also sort of gets to the point that we made on our previous podcast, and that the show has come to make explicitly in many ways, which is that this is a show about how political power, the quest for it, the desire for it, and the exercise of it makes you awful. It makes you worse than you need to be, even when you have high ideals. And this is actually, this has always been the strongest case against Daenerys, is that she has had high ideals, and yet in practice, when she has ruled, it has often ended, it has not ended in a sort of high ideal world, right? It has not given us a sort of peaceful and wonderful utopia. And so once again, she gets to the point of ruling, right? She is in the process of taking over, and that process is what makes her awful and makes her not just awful, it's what makes her a mass murderer, right? And
so
this is a show that equates power with mass murder.
I actually think that that's been the development in this season, is that before this season, we were seeing politics making people behave badly, broadly speaking, and occasionally violently. But what this season has done is say, like, actually, by the way, in case you had forgotten, all government power, all political power is ultimately backed by the threat of violence. You know, it's done at the point of a dragon. And that's, as a theme coming to the fore, certainly made my little libertarian heart happy, even as I watched Elizabeth Warren's dreams burn.
Yeah, I mean, it's an anti-power show, and it's also an anti-war show, right? I mean, like, the last 20 or 30 minutes of the most recent episode, as the dragon is burning King's Landing, are kind of over the top and gratuitous. And this is, I think, something that you felt, Catherine, while you were watching. Certainly, I've heard other people kind of describe this as, like, at first they're like, wait a minute, this is going way too far. This is gross. This is just unnecessary. Oh, this is unnecessary and over the top for a reason.
Absolutely. The transition as the episode moved on from what felt like cinematic violence for the sake of cinematic violence,
which
this show does for sure. Like, oh, look, here's a bunch of blood spraying and swords crunching people's noses and whatever. But there's sort of a point somewhere when Arya stumbles out of her third dead end alleyway where I had an aha moment, and I think many viewers did, of like, we're trying to help the viewer experience what it is like to be in a war zone and the pointlessness and futility and stupidness and horror that is unrelenting and unceasing. And I actually thought it was a super cool artistic choice. I really liked that aspect.
And it was very visually striking, although I kind of missed the days on Game of Thrones where Tyrion would get knocked over the head, the battle would occur off screen, and then we'd have more time for discussions of the battles.
Like, maybe a smaller CGI budget actually was better.
And, you know, and I totally agree, the show has pivoted toward really discussing the kind of libertarian themes that get us excited to talk about. At the same time, I mean, the execution of her taking the city just made so much that came before it seemed completely pointless.
Right.
This could have been done. I mean, so the week, I really liked the episode before this one, which had a lot more talking, but also made it seem like the dragons were now not this just unstoppable threat with Euron easily killing one of them, the city armed with all these ballista type. I thought they were saying, okay, it's going to be more complicated than it looks.
And then it was like, nope. Much simpler. Right.
Hard, and in fact, that was frustrating to me.
This is a lesson that I think the show and the books, like, grappled with very well until this episode, which was this idea that everyone in the show is morally complicated. Like, there's not a real good guy, bad guy scenario.
There's a couple of just bad guys.
There are outliers, but for the most part, even the people who are attempting to do good are doing bad things. And even the people who are attempting to pursue selfish ends sometimes produce unselfish side effects. I mean, I think the show did a pretty good job of saying, like, listen, people seek power for all kinds of reasons, and the results can be various. And then this was like, oh yeah, she just went crazy and did a crazy thing, which is not actually how, for the most part, politics or even monarchical succession in whatever quasi-medieval period this is supposed to be set in really function for the
It's
most
even
part.
Speaking to, what is it? It's the C.S. Lewis quote, right? About how I'd rather be ruled by the tyrants, or the tyrants who want to help me are even more threatening. I mean, Daenerys is the tyrant who wants to help you, right? And just like utterly burns your city to the ground compared to Cersei, who's just kind of indifferent to everyone else and was only burning like the people who were against her.
So let's take a minute now in that context to talk about Varys. So R.I.P. Varys.
Yeah.
Who... in the show is presented in a very uncomplicated way toward the end. I mean, he wants what's best for the realm. And we more or less, as viewers, are asked to take that as a true thing, right? I mean, early, we don't know. He has complicated allegiances. But by this last season, Varys says, my loyalties have always been with the realm and the people of Westeros, and they shall always be. And we're meant to believe him, basically. What do we think about that? Do we think about Varys's end in light of that?
I thought that Varys's death and the short lead up to it at the beginning of the last episode was the best part of last episode. And it's not by accident, it's the talkiest part, right? It's the part that sort of gets into like that gets into the kind of the political machinations.
There's a little bit of monologuing.
Yeah. I think I am willing to believe in the idea of actually good public servants. I think that there aren't that many of them, and often there certainly aren't enough of them for bureaucracy to work very well. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that there are zero of them. We lost a great public servant in real life recently, the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, Alice Rivlin, who and like she's kind of like Varys in certain ways, you know, in her sort of connected
is Varys,
in her connected
excellence,
right? And like I had some disagreements with her, as I had some disagreements with Varys, but you always knew that she was honest and decent, looking out for the interests of the Republic. And I think that that's sort of true with how Varys is as well. But it's also Varys is there to make a contrast with Tyrion. And Tyrion, whose loyalty is to the mad ruler and to the personality, and it is there to make, I think, an argument that Tyrion's choice, at least in this moment, to support Dany is a mistake.
So I want to go full Jonathan Haidt on this episode just for a quick minute, because I do think you're right that we have sort of loyalty to an ideal in Varys versus loyalty to an individual. But Varys is also, like, you could frame it that way, but you could also frame Varys as essentially a pragmatic character, right? That Varys is just trying to figure out how to make it work. He is calculating up the utils. He is trying to figure out what maximizes the utilitarian calculus in this scenario. I obviously am anti-loyalty because I'm just a robot brain. But what Jonathan Haidt says is that actually honor and loyalty are values that people, broadly speaking, on the American right have, whereas people on the left are concerned only with care harm. Right, they are concerned only with sort of who gets hurt or who doesn't get hurt, who gets helped and doesn't get helped.
Well, I mean, he says that people on the right are much more motivated by those.
So
values.
People on the
Not
right
that,
actually are motivated.
No
by
one
both
on
of
the
these.
Left has any loyalty at all.
Of course, I'm oversimplifying, but Haidt says, listen, there are multiple facets of political personality. They are more various. In particular, these ones about honor and loyalty are exhibited on the right, and they are largely absent on the left. And this is one reason that people on the left have such a hard time projecting themselves into the position of people on the right or understanding what people on the right are doing that they see as a moral thing. The show also seems to be saying loyalty boo, at least to Tyrion.
It's against loyalty to a specific leader, right? It's not against loyalty to an idea or to a
But it's
place.
Against loyalty to a specific leader whose claim rests on authority or heredity too, right? Like presumably it would not be wrong to be loyal to a leader who's producing good outcomes.
I think Tyrion's point comes across as a little bit defensible. Like how many times are we going to switch ruler? You know, every time we just desert our and back a new ruler, that causes strife, that causes issues. It's not so easy. Are we really ready to throw over Daenerys? We've done all this work toward getting to this point over some of these things. I mean, obviously, Varys is correct. The show positions Varys to be correct and Tyrion to be wrong, and then bears out what he's saying. Varys is... I mean, this is the last time I can do this, so I have to do this. In the books, it's not like that, blah, blah, blah. He clearly is motivated by loyalty to a specific branch of the Targaryens.
A branch which has been erased from the show.
Right. Well, and there's a rumored Aegon Targaryen introduced late in the books who is now probably going to be a rival with Dany, who Varys seems loyal to. And they've actually kind of just shifted that character into Jon by saying his name is secretly Aegon. So a lot of these actually relationships, I think, might get worked out by the fact that this character is a distinct character in the books. But for the show, that's what they had to do. So Varys's motivations don't always quite add up to me in like light of what he did earlier. If this is no, he was always for the realm, that feels like some shorthand. I also thought it was kind of, he kind of just marches to his, it was perfunctory. He didn't see this coming at all.
The death scene?
Yeah, well he just knew it was gonna, like, he didn't try to escape this. He should have seen this. It felt like we have to be rid of this right, character, like onto new things.
The Master of Whispers couldn't have gotten like a taxi out of there at the last hot second.
I will take your criticism. It was rushed, as all things have been this season. Nearly even the good ideas in the season have been underdeveloped. And so even Varys's death, which I said was the best part of last episode, like a better show would have made basically a whole episode around Varys.
Yes.
First trying to escape, you know, sort of maybe trying to escape or sort of trying to get out of it or sort of you see what's it. And instead we got, 12, 15 minutes at the beginning of this. But we did get that scene with the rings and the suggestion that perhaps he has laid that he has plans that will outlive him.
Yeah. I mean, this was actually the first time we saw him interact with his little birds. We've seen Qyburn interact with the little birds. And that's interesting. Yeah. I would love to see more about how...
Want a whole, FBI plot.
Yes. The showrunners preferring and doing a great job with spectacle, with, you know, oh my gosh, the Sandor Clegane approaching his brother on the staircase with it. Like, beautiful, gorgeous imagery. They're so good at that. But what Game of Thrones is really about is, I think, more of those finer details that have really gotten the shaft.
So we still have this kind of open question of having carefully laid the plan to de-escalate when the bells ring, and that plan having so utterly failed. You know, I don't think that Tyrion's facial expression has actually changed this entire season. He just has this kind of like, what? I've been disappointed again by everyone around me? It's like that kind of hangdog face. So
it's very similar to the face that a lot of early Trump advisors just made, right? And like he's sort of like the guy who's like, well, I should probably serve in this administration, even though, oh boy.
And then it's like, oh. Yeah, he's like the, what was that?
The John Kelly.
The John Kelly of the administration.
Gary Cohn.
You know, we see him. We see a cut to him after the bells ring and Daenerys chooses to light the place up. Anyway, I could not necessarily 100% read what we were supposed to think Tyrion was thinking in this moment. Is he defecting?
I think he's turning on her.
Is he loyal? What do we see?
I think he's turning on her.
I'm not 100% sure what we are supposed to see on Tyrion's face in that moment. Is that his moment of realization that Daenerys is not worthy of his loyalty? Or is that his like, well, in for a penny, in for a pound?
I thought he's choosing to turn on her. I mean, that's what makes most narrative sense after Varys, you know, not sacrifices himself exactly, but is taken out of the picture. This is his death thought, is I hope I'm wrong about Daenerys, but he's now been shown to be right. I think this will be a bridge too far for Tyrion. And, you know, we have some other characters in the mix. I would expect to see some kind of Tyrion, Jon, maybe others grappling seriously with getting rid of Daenerys in this last episode. That's what makes sense to me. I'm not 100% sure that's what's going to happen or that it will succeed, but that certainly makes sense, isn't it?
I think it's certainly setting us up with that expectation. On the other hand, there is, I mean, presuming that like that the showrunners here follow at all the spirit of George R.R. Martin and his books,
Which I think they are doing, which badly yes, at times, but are doing.
Right. I mean, I think that Martin was planning the Daenerys turn at least. George R. R. Martin often kind of makes the point that things just don't turn out nice. And I think it is at least possible, I don't want to say likely, but at least possible, Dany ends up on the throne, just kind of ruling over the wastes, and that Tyrion ends up kind of deciding to support her somehow or another. Or, you know, maybe he joins a plot to try and take her down and it fails, but then sort of at the end just pledges his loyalty anyway. But I think actually, like, to me, one of the most interesting remaining questions is what happens to Tyrion? Because Tyrion, certainly, like, in some of the middle seasons that were the best, Tyrion was the closest thing that the show had to a main character. He was, in a lot of ways, the pivotal character through whom we all experienced the rest of the events of the show, right? And he's not just a fan favorite. He is, in many ways, the meter, right? Like, he's the little, you know, the needle on NewYorkTimes.com on election night, right? That, like, that shows us sort of exactly, like, how bad things are, how people are feeling about stuff. Is that needle just actually
connected to his blood alcohol level, or?
Which is probably too low right now.
I mean, honestly, like, he probably did go into the Battle of King's Landing relatively sober, and I bet he's regretting that.
He looked really quite sober after the long night.
Yeah.
Right? Like he'd had, like, that night was a long night for him in a different way than for other people.
Yeah.
And like, maybe he's laying off the sauce for a couple of days.
I think he's going to help try to put Jon on the throne. If I had to guess, I say it results in both of those characters, Jon and Daenerys, taking each other out. And I'm still thinking it's Queen Sansa is what we're being set up for.
So let's,
I'm standing by that prediction.
Let's talk about the closest thing the show has to a thesis of what makes a good ruler, which is what we heard from Varys a couple episodes ago, in which he says the best ruler is the person who doesn't want to rule. There was a lot of response to that online. I am tempted by that theory for obvious reasons. But, you know, Jon Snow is someone who doesn't want to rule. Sansa is also someone who doesn't want to rule, right? Like, I mean, she's said when queried a couple of times by different characters, nope, Jon is king in the north or some variation thereof. Are we being set up for Queen Sansa? And is the best ruler the one who doesn't want to rule?
Yes. So Jon shows how being good at ruling and being good at holding on to political power are completely different and often incompatible things, because Jon is unwilling to
also,
do the things.
By the way, the third thing, good at, like, strategy and tactics, which he has shown himself to be a garbage person at. No?
I mean, yeah, people say that. He's also been sometimes good at strategy and tactics. Like, he was good during the whole Battle of the Wall in the fourth season, right, when the Wildlings attack. They made him bad at it for the Battle of the Bastards because they needed to show Sansa as ultimately more competent. One of the reasons I think we're building toward a Sansa endgame, because she's always shown to be right. But Jon has been, you know, he literally got stabbed in the back and killed because he's not good at anticipating the kinds of things that Cersei and Daenerys have been good at anticipating and just utterly preemptively killing anyone in their way. He doesn't do that. He's a good guy. So he's a good ruler, but he doesn't hold on to political power. Maybe Sansa, who has learned from people like Cersei and Littlefinger, is a little bit better about accumulating political power, but in a way that is not so morally questionable. The story of Sansa is finding a happy middle ground between, like, the Cersei Littlefinger, etc., and, like, the Stark pure moral goodness,
like,
that gets
everyone's head gets
killed.
Chopped off every time. Yeah, I mean, I think the other piece of that, right, is it's a, there's a localist lesson, or like a federalist lesson. It's like,
certainly,
her loyalties are to the north. That's a clearer and less complicated question in many ways than what it would mean to rule the Seven Kingdoms and to sort of gain influence among the diverse people.
And she has shown not exactly delegating authority, but asking relevant involved decision makers for what they think should be done about. They do show her doing that a lot. Like,
they
when
do.
She's talking
they show
other,
like,
north,
walking
northern
around
people
in the keep in her black cloak.
Asking, well, should we be doing this? Oh, that's interesting, you know.
No, obviously, I was like, I pledge my loyalty to her right now when she was like, do you think we
when
should
do when you saw the full body armor dress.
Well, first of all, the dress, yes, but like 100% on the dress. But also, like, no, like when she's like down with the, like, master of salt pork being like, do we need to put more of these in the cellar? I was like, thank God someone's finally doing this. Like, oh my God, plan for the long winter. Although I guess now we have yet to sort of learn, and maybe will not learn, is the Long Winter over now that the Night King is dead? We don't know.
Sansa, master of quality management. It's like she's the only person in the show who's been to business school.
Yeah. No, Sansa's MBA is really paying off right now. It's great. I guess like it was the like MBA in the like Littlefinger School of Management, which is not optimal in some ways.
You know, your teachers are not always great people themselves, but you can still learn lessons from them.
Mm. Speaking of The Long Night, which was mostly just a showcase for Arya's awesomeness. I mean, so this is a season I was trying to sketch out who has been. What characters have been treated well this season and which characters have been treated badly. And basically Sansa and Arya and Gendry, I guess, have gotten like the super edits, like lots of cool, great stuff happening for them.
They like got new powers.
If you're Arya or Sansa, like you are very happy about how this is turning out. If you're Daenerys, you're sad, which is true actually to the actors and actresses, which now I'm seeing, you know, when they were asked questions about the season, they can't give anything away. But like Jon, Sansa, Cersei, those actors and actresses had like, whereas Arya and Sansa were like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I mean,
so,
and
no surprise there.
And Arya and Sansa's arcs are in some ways a complication of the kind of the feminist narrative that's like, well, because Daenerys has gone mad, this show is anti-feminist. And I think that's
absolutely
just
wrong.
That's just not right. The show's not making a comment about Daenerys because she's a woman. It's because she is someone who seeks power. And it just argues constantly that power seeking is poisonous to the Republic and to the individual soul. And because Arya and Sansa don't do that, and because they sort of seek excellence in different ways, they come off much better.
And also, I really do think it's an overlooked point that all of Daenerys's failings are a result of her family lineage. So, like, the madness is not female madness. Right. It's Targaryen madness. The madness is from a non-gendered source. And also, her belief that she could sweep in and rule is, like, the stories she was told as a child by her exiled family, right? This is not a failure of judgment exactly. It's a failure of education. And I think that's been undervalued in kind of evaluating her character. But, you know, I think this image, this dream that she had of the throne room, right, with what we thought was snow but is maybe ash sifting down, certainly we're set up for that now.
The idea of ruling over ashes is a theme, is something that the show and the books have talked about many times. That's actually the Mad King's dying declaration when he commands the wildfire to be lit. He says something like, well, Robert has won the city, but he will rule over charred and cooked bones and meat, and he will be the king of ashes. And so that metaphor of that you will just sit on a throne surrounded by
she'll
be the queen of ashes.
So let's talk very briefly before we get into some kind of like macro show dynamics. I want to talk about the Arya Hound conversation, because I think that's, you could read that as just a narrow point, right? Like the Hound is literally just saying, my character is unhappy. You, a different character who is younger, has a chance to be happy. Go. Or you can read it, I think, more broadly as like there are all these characters on the show who are consumed with revenge or power or what is their right or their due. The minute that Arya walks out of that conversation, she's very mortal, though. Like the superhero Arya of the previous episodes is totally gone. And we see her just kind of stumbling and lost and bloodied and making bad decisions and trying to be heroic and immediately striking out.
Well, making imperfect decisions because it's
because
difficult
of all the choices were bad. Right.
But, because it's difficult to make good decisions in the moment when your city is literally collapsing.
Right. But like, I don't know about you, but like that moment when she like looks at all the women and children and she's like, we got to get out of here, guys. I was like, oh, this is what she is now. She's like a defender of the defenseless. And like, this is her new mission in life. And then immediately they stumble out into the street and are separated. And like, she can't help anyone. And it's terrible. And I kind of liked that. Like, oh, maybe this is what it means for Arya to live a normal life. And it's like, oh, nope, not that either. I suppose that's undermined, though, by the magical appearance of the White Horse.
They do a really good job with Arya, to be frank, I think. She's a superhero, but she's a complicated superhero, the way superheroes should be. I thought her moment with the Hound was like the Hound saying, I'm too far gone. I cannot be helped. I have, you know, what we might describe as like mental illness almost. I have a pathological need to kill my brother, even though I know it is going to kill me. You have had thoughts of revenge. You have executed on your desire for revenge, but you can still have something approaching connection to human beings that is not purely driven by revenge. And she heard that and she backed out of that. And, you know, she's still a survivor. She's still, but she wasn't in Arya. She shifts from Arya assassin mode to Arya vulnerable little girl, not little girl, but 16.
Vulnerable growing up.
Vulnerable, definitely past the age of consent woman, Robbie.
We won't get into an age of consent discussion here. But,
we never should.
But this does raise the question of, does she go back to Gendry? And right. Does she, right, is like
no,
Arya's...
Is
I think she very well might.
No.
Is the end of Arya's arc that she's just like raising little super assassins?
No, I hope not. I mean, I guess... My guess is there is no end of Arya's arc, or we don't answer that question. Like, we'll see her again in the next episode, but I don't think we're going to answer that question.
I mean, I think we might see her kill Daenerys in the next episode. That, I mean, this, you're saying this was part of her. I was seeing this as giving her motivation, giving Tyrion motivation, giving Jon motivation, giving the other main players reason to take out Daenerys. She has to, I mean, if we're believing the eyes theory, she has to kill someone with green eyes. She's killed someone with brown eyes and blue eyes. People expected that to be Cersei because Cersei has green eyes. Daenerys in the show, not in the books, importantly,
yes,
but in the show does
they
have
go
green
out
eyes.
Of their way to show her green eyes, yes, in the confrontation of the battlements. Okay, I want to now have us talk, just since we mentioned superheroes, about what I am experiencing. I need you guys to talk me through what I'm experiencing, which is basically like enthusiasm fatigue. I have been very stoked about this series. I was very, very stoked at the beginning of the season. I feel like I'm the distracted boyfriend meme. And it's just like Endgame and also like a new novel that I've been reading. And also like the series of Good Omens is coming out, which I'm very excited about. Like, I'm already over Game of Thrones, but like the world isn't, right? Like, did I get in too deep too fast? What was my mistake? Why have I lost my enthusiasm?
I think that you are probably a little further past, a little more over than Game of Thrones than most people. But two people who I think share being over Game of Thrones with you are Benioff and Weiss, the showrunners. and I actually think that, well, you know, people have sort of talked about what's the reason for why the show
has... Yeah, if I think I've been too into this show, like, they've definitely been
what's,
too into
like,
the
and
show.
And so this has been a big topic of discussion is, why are these seasons so rushed? Why has the plotting kind of really fallen down and the show has just become an exercise in cinematic spectacle on the small screen? And what I think is that Benioff and Weiss just got tired of this. Running a show is actually an exceptionally difficult job. They've been doing this now for something like a decade of the prime of their life. They are huge superstars in Hollywood. Their next big project has been announced. It is Star Wars. They are going to go get to run Star Wars for a decade. And so these guys had the opportunity to make both longer episodes and more episodes. HBO has, like, they have confirmed this. And they said they apparently were the ones who requested, we only want to do 13 episodes. That's it. And then it'll be over. And George R. R. Martin actually said something like, well, I mean, you know, we could go for 10 or 12 or 14, a very George R. R. Martin response. We could basically go for an infinity number of seasons, and I don't see why we wouldn't. But Benioff and Weiss, this is very nearly a quote, they want to have a life, I guess. And like, it really seems to me to be an acknowledgement of the fact that these guys were exhausted by producing the show. And that is, I think, reflected in the quality of this season.
That's all correct, but you're saying that in too sympathetic a way. I mean, everything you said is right, but I'm furious about it. It's they stopped trying, or they stopped caring on something that I care a lot about, that tons of people do, and they just decided it's not nearly as good as it could have been because they're not trying and they're sick of it.
They don't owe you their effort.
Well, then they should
man.
Just stop and let someone else do it or something. It makes me angry. It frankly makes me angry. I'm a defender of Martin. I think what he has done is not finished yet, but I trust him and the things he's worked out, and I'm really excited for the books.
That really sounds like misplaced trust, TBH.
I don't know. No, everybody say, oh, he's never going to finish them. I'll judge him when they come out.
I don't really think it's even never going to finish or is going to finish. I think it's just like the idea that like George R. R. Martin will deliver where Benioff and Weiss have not. Like, I don't know that George R. R. Martin has shown a lot of confidence that George R. R. Martin can deliver.
I don't agree. I think the books are great, and a lot of the criticisms of them are not quite fair, and I'm really excited to see where it goes. There will always be that when the show ends disappointingly.
I really like the idea, though, that George R. R. Martin's books are now like fan fiction of his own work, right? Like if the show is canon in the hearts of the vast majority of consumers now, right? Like, there will be a canonical ending of the show, which means that whatever George R. R. Martin comes after will be almost like a, it'll be like an alternate ending. It'll be like a looped timeline.
If
it'll
J.K.
be,
Rowling can write fan fiction about right, her characters, which she's basically been doing.
And also, by the way, like, all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is basically just fan fiction.
Yes.
Too. So, like, maybe that distinction doesn't make any sense anymore. But I think, you know, the extent to which his later books will be lesser entries in the perception of the canon.
I think the later books might be better because now test run, because he's seen how we react to certain things, and he's going to make sure he spends the requisite time building to some of these developments. Perhaps my faith is entirely misplaced.
I mean, they might be better, but
I think they still won't be perceived as definitive anymore.
It is kind of amazing to look back and see, like, the first couple of books were written in like a space of like 5 years. I mean, he just turned out a thousands and thousands of well-regarded, I should say, I have not read the books, but they laid the groundwork for the best seasons of the show. They are considered by the fans to be the better books, and he just sort of burned through them. It was not a so slow and arduous pace, right? It was just like, I'm going to churn out a huge amount of plot and character. And, you know, in that process, he kept discovering that there was more and more and more plot and character. And now here we are, like, 20 plus years later.
Yeah. But I mean, the sixth season, which was totally outside of the thrust of the novels, just based on what Martin had told the showrunners, but was a full 10-episode season that they put a lot of effort into, was pretty great. In my view, I think most people think it was pretty great. It has the door episode, the conclusion, the Sept destruction, Daenerys' forces finally sailing to Westeros, Jon becoming King of the North, Battle of the Bastards, all that. It did a really good job, which, again, so, like, frustrates me, because when they had the room to really bring it home, they were doing fine. But these last two seasons are just,
I think, the thing that that bugs me the most is not even so much the shortened seasons, but the fact that the way they have given up on writing good scenes. Yeah. And, like, this is a thing that you really notice. There were a couple of them in the episode after The Long Night. Just a couple. And they were good. They weren't great, but they were good. But this is what drew, I think, a lot of us into the show. I mean, yes, there were the kind of the big shock endings, the Red Wedding, the death, of Sean Bean's character at the beginning of the end of the first season, that sort of thing. But it wasn't just about sort of the shock moments. And it certainly wasn't about the spectacle, which didn't really get amped up until some of the later seasons when the show was popular enough for HBO to justify the expenditures. Instead, what it was were these, like, great characters, really quite good acting in a lot of cases, not all, but in a lot of cases, and really, really great scripting, right? Like, there were just, like, incredibly memorable scenes that within the scenes had, you know, these little arcs, and right, and it was a show about dialogue and about how people talked and how people thought and how they acted and their motivations. And that has just been almost completely gone. This is just about knocking down plot dominoes and rushing.
There was structure in the episode, like, okay, this episode, it will begin and end with Sam and Gilly north of the wall, and very exciting, the encounter White Walker. Main thrust of the episode is two or three mini arcs taking place at King's Landing and Dragonstone and somewhere else. We're actually not going to visit the regular North this episode. We will. Each episode had a kind of logic for how it was being.
And they got distracted a little bit sometimes, too. I mean, like, there was way too much sand snakes.
A lot of sand.
Way
sticks.
Too much.
They were
sand
so
sticks.
Sexy, though, in those, like, drapey outfits and their poison lipstick.
Yeah, poison really, you with sex.
That's actually the one thing that I want from the final episode is, like, a
sexy
30
outfits
minute
and poison lipstick.
It's like a 30-minute, like, flashback to the sand snakes as children, so we, like, really find out what they were like.
I mean, I'm first of all 100% in favor of that, despite its structural fun.
No, like, we're gonna get that.
I mean,
that's how I feel about the Greyjoys and the Iron Islands.
Right.
Any moment,
but this
spent
is.
The Greyjoys is
very
a
early
moment.
On, if you remember, the opening sequence where you swooped around that little animated map, like, you in the earlier seasons, you would carefully watch that opening sequence so that you would know which of the many locational subplots we were going to be following. And there was lots of information there. And like that opening sequence, though it has been reworked to be actually much fancier and nicer looking in many ways in the later seasons, doesn't have a function anymore. Like it still technically does touch on the places where the story is going to take place, but it's just the Wall, Winterfell, King's Landing.
Metaphor for everything wrong with the seasons.
Right. It just closed and it telescoped in, whereas the initial purpose of that animated map was to show you how it was constantly expanding outward and involving so many different people and places, I think. I want to also just remind us, though, the goodness of this show, and I think for the reasons that Peter just described and how Robbie described early on, it overcame America's bias against fantasy. Like, in a very real way, like, I think we should just, like, maybe close on this note of, like, this show convinced people, including me, I mean, these books, I guess, convinced me that, like, stuff with dragons wasn't inherently bad.
Dragons and kings and swords.
Like, that was a thing against which even nerd culture was internally biased, much less mainstream culture. And now it is totally acceptable to be on the DC subway talking about which of the dragon queen's tactics will succeed in an imaginary medieval realm.
And to have like an office D&D game.
Right. So this is, it's coincided with the rise of other parts of dragon-based nerd culture.
Dragon-based nerd culture is a thing that totally exists, and I'd never heard it labeled that.
It's
before,
literally was the it's... part of nerd culture that I looked down on for my whole life as a nerd until recently. Like, I am part of this trend. Like, what does it mean, Robbie? Why do we suddenly approve of dragon-based nerd culture? Is it just the genius of George R. R. Martin?
I mean, it's that, or it showed that there was an appetite for this that wasn't being filled, that you could do something like this and it would be incredibly popular. I mean, I think part of the reason is it's like, if you do a really great job with it, people will like it. I mean, the level of detail, think of the costumes. Think of like the people in Dorne, the level of attention played to how Prince Oberyn Martell dresses versus how the people in King's Landing dress.
None of this is possible without the success of the Lord of the Rings movies beforehand, right?
Yes.
Like, in fact,
if they're also great.
If there is a Typhoid Mary of dragon-based nerd culture in the modern era, it is not Game of Thrones,
which were huge Lord popular hits. The other thing, though, that I would say is just to relate back to your enthusiasm fatigue with things like Avengers Endgame is that it's actually weirdly difficult to remember. But when we were kids, like in the 1980s, even being into comic books and superheroes marked you as a weirdo and a nerd. It was not cool at all. And now it absolutely dominates pop culture. It's post cool. It doesn't, like, cool people are into it, uncool people, everyone is into it.
Yeah.
And and Game of Thrones has ridden and partaken and sort of that wave. How can you partake in a wave? It has ridden that wave and also been sort of helped
it has
swell,
swum
right?
inside the wave. It has
right, it's
powered
been part
the
of
wave.
That is that nerd culture has completely taken over the middle and even upper middle brow, and like certainly Game of Thrones at its best is upper middle brow. That's what HBO has always done, right? And it's kind of notable, like the transition over the last 25 years from The Sopranos, which was the first really big hit for HBO, to Game of Thrones, which is a much bigger hit for HBO, right? And like one was, yes, it was a gangster show, but it was like a really kind of arch, smart, subversive gangster show. And this is a fantasy show. And on the other hand, it's also like an arch, smart, subversive fantasy show. And what HBO has done is add realism and brains to like a kind of smartness to these very conventional genres. And you see that with Deadwood, which is, you know, just a Western, except not just a Western. And you see that with The Wire, which is just a police procedural, except not just a police procedural. And, you know, and so part of it is about showing people that these genres and the ideas that have been contained in them for decades just go a lot deeper. And I think that's still true even here in the last season, even as the show has gotten a little kind of simpler and shallower. Like, this is still a much smarter show than would have been possible on television 25 years ago.
Yes, all that. You know, I mean, so the comparison I make here is to Lost, which was the other show that I was even more obsessed with Lost than I am with Game of Thrones.
If such a thing is possible.
I know, everyone's going to go, really? You can go back and read I would stay up all night writing recaps of the episode in my college dorm room. This was like my first experience with like writing television stuff. Rob Z888.
Who says that people don't learn anything?
Hey, don't talk over it. People need Robbie's.
Rob Z888.
Robbie's Lost fandom username.
You'll also find some of my forms. Never mind. But Lost also had a final season that was a fans regarded as something of a letdown. And that has.
Because it was.
Yeah, I would be less critical of its final season than I am of Game of Thrones. Probably most of the fans would be the opposite way. How has it changed how people remember Lost? I think it has a little bit. I don't know if Game of Thrones will be the same. People will be like, oh yeah, it all went off the rails. I don't think that's going to happen the same way it did with Lost. But
where do we think that Game of Thrones ranks in the pantheon of great television? Generally, and in the end, we haven't seen the final episode, so we don't know how it's going to land or not. And where do we think it's likely to end up in terms of how well did this show end? Because a lot of these shows, this is really a thing, a lot of these shows that people love and obsess over and think
struggle
are like the best
to stick
shows,
the landing.
Yeah, it's hard to think of one that just Breaking Bad is probably the one comes closest to having an ending that most of the fans agreed
was good enough.
Was at least good enough. Yeah,
I think the closest parallel is going to be Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, that is one that had a final episode that people were just infuriated with.
I think there is a chance for this last episode, which we have not seen at the time of taping, to take this show straight to Battlestar Galactica mode, which is to say, infuriating last episode, but still a thing people will rewatch and generally think fondly of.
Right.
Like the badness of the final episode or final season may not be the only thing that the show's reputation rests on. I, as a big fan of BBC Sherlock, I am already totally inured to any bad show ending because no show could let me down more than the last season or last episode of that show, which was just randomly part of the Saw franchise all of the sudden. My rage knows no bounds, but also I'm numb now. So do what you will.
Did it
Benioff
make you
hate
Benedict Cumberbatch?
Nothing could do that, Peter.
Okay. So it could have been worse.
It wasn't his fault.
I actually think now that I think about it, the best ending I think I've ever seen to a show that was great throughout and then was The Americans. And the final episode of The Americans is just masterful in every way. And I don't think Game of Thrones has a chance to live up to that. They could make this season worthwhile in certain ways, however, I'm not sure they will.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Best case scenario is they could make this season worthwhile in certain ways. You heard it here first. The revenge of the nerds is upon us. We will see how it goes. Thank you very much, Peter Suderman and Robbie Suave, for joining me for this very special and final Reason Game of Thrones podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.